Welcome to Everything But The Tip, the podcast that bucks the trend of the mainstream golf content being churned out by the masses. Presented by the co-founders of Smart Golf and Fitness, we're on a mission to guide golfers towards genuine improvement. No swing tips, no shortcuts, we're anti-instant gratification. Join us as we navigate the complexities of the game, offering insights on how to truly excel in golf by embracing the challenges and breaking free from the usual quick fix mentality. All right, and we're back with part two of our follow-up series to our physical screen episode. Tonight, we're going to be going through some more swing characteristics or faults, whatever we decide to call them tonight.
Faults.
But now there's actually one we'll actually speak to tonight, maybe more than one that, you know, I might be convinced that it's more of a characteristic. Anyhow, we want to highlight the physical causes of those swing flaws or characteristics, and we want to offer more insight in how we attack those both from a physical and drill perspective. So we'll follow a very similar format like we did in our last episode. We're going to tell you what the characteristic is. We're going to tell you the physical causes or potential physical causes of that physical characteristic, the mechanical implications on your golf swing, some physical corrections, and then lastly, some drills. Tommy, welcome.
Hey, good to be here. Good to be here again, Joe. I think this is a pretty good episode. Did a little research, so I did confirm that there are now 18 confirmed swing characteristics or faults as recognized by TPI. So we'll go through all of them over the course of tonight and the next couple of weeks, probably. We'll break them out.
We did four last episode. We have six on the docket tonight.
Yeah, we got six, so we got a lot to do. But again, yeah, just when I look at these things, they show up because your body, again, is trying to take the path of least resistance to produce power. So these things manifest themselves due to some sort of physical limitation. So we'll talk about what those are. You'll find tonight there's kind of a recurring theme. You'll hear some similar things across these different characteristics. And it's we'll also find out that one of the characteristics we talked about last week actually lends itself to this other fault or characteristic. So we'll talk a little bit about which one that is and how correcting that can potentially get rid of another problem that manifests itself. But last week, just a quick review, we went through mostly postural faults. We went through the S posture, the C posture. We went through loss of posture and flat shoulder plane. And tonight we're going to go through six of them. And we categorize them into a loose category of like backswing and transition. Basically, the things we'll go through this week and next week will definitely tie together. So it's not a perfect categorization, but that's kind of way my brain kind of looked at them. So
yeah, we're doing our best to try to go in order. You know, a lot of the conversation stemmed around address. So now we're moving along through the golf swing, and naturally that's going to be your backswing and then transition. They don't fit perfectly into those categories. I think we were actually talking about it. I think it's going to make sense to do some future episodes that allow us to dive deeper and be more beyond just the swing characteristics, but the actual positions in the golf swing.
The P's,
the P system. I don't necessarily love to communicate, you know, using P1, P2 with my students, but it's definitely something, a useful tool when you're trying to speak a common language and communicating with fellow professionals in the industry. There's 10 positions, address all the way through the finish. You know, and I think just by only talking about the swing characteristics, we limit ourselves in some of the information that we're able to share with some of our listeners to actually some other movement patterns and positions in the golf swing that don't necessarily fall under the conversation when we're speaking to the 18 swing characteristics.
Right. But I think getting some background on these, you know, characteristics that are, you know, that we've seen in a lot of different golfers will give some good background information, and then we can always reference back. But I think putting an episode together talking about the P's and the swing faults characteristics would just be like, just I think it would be a lot of information. So I think there's some good background stuff that'll definitely feed right into that P conversation and make that an exciting episode as well.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's get started with the first swing characteristic slash fault tonight.
Yeah. What is that, Joe?
Well, we're going to start with a very common swing characteristic slash fault, and that is the sway. So for those who do not know what the sway is, technically you can refer to both the upper and lower body when you're talking about lateral motion in the golf swing, but we're going to highlight lower today.
And sway essentially is just what we would define as excessive lateral action with the lower body, hips, in your backswing.
Right. So if anybody's been to a golf lesson before, you might see those lines on your hips. You have a little bit of a weight shift into that trail leg. But if that hip moves well outside of that line, that's basically what we're talking about as far as the sway?
That's perfectly stated. So, yeah, we like to draw a line up from the outside of the trail ankle all the way up through the outside of the hip. It's actually okay if it's actually even touching the leg. And, yeah, ideally, we'll talk about it here shortly, you want to look, there's a certain and most appropriate way to load up into that trail side. And when that hip starts to kick out beyond that line, yes, you are now have entered the category of sway.
Gotcha. So you probably want to know what parts of the body lend themselves to sway.
Your turn, Tommy. Let's hear it.
Great. So this one's pretty simple. You talked about the hips, talked about rotation. So one of the things we look at in the physical screen, which is super important, is internal rotation. So any limitation in internal rotation in that trail leg, so right leg for the right-hand golfers, left leg for those that stand on the wrong side of the ball, just kidding, is going to lend itself to a sway. So just to give you a visual on what internal rotation is, for any smokers out there, if you put your cigarette butt down and you turn your foot inwards like you're trying to put the butt of the cigarette out on the ground, that's internal rotation. So just simply turning your toe inwards, every time you make a backswing, ideally you get some internal rotation into that hip. So any limitation there will cause that sway, that excessive movement laterally there. Any inability to disassociate your trunk from your pelvis, so create some separation between your upper body and lower body. So again, if we take a look at a backswing video, ideally the shoulders have rotated further than the hips. So we test people, again, just in a square position, excuse me, and try to see if they can move their shoulders separate of the hips. That's going to be one of the recurring themes you kind of hear tonight is disassociation, pretty important to a lot of these characteristics or faults we'll talk about. And then weakness in the lateral hip and the glutes. So glutes and hips are the main stabilizers in the lower part of the golf swing. If you don't have adequate strength and stability in that area, you're not going to be able to create load there, and you're going to move off that line into the backswing.
Is it worth highlighting the ankles?
Yeah, I mean, the ankles are always where we start because they connect you to the ground. So as you get down a few more of these faults, the ankles we'll talk a little bit more about. But, I mean, realistically, we could say the ankles are going to cause any of these faults.
Fair enough. All right, so mechanical implications on your golf swing. You know, I think there's going to be a common theme when it comes to really any of these swing characteristics, and I think we highlighted a little bit in our past episode, and this does fall in line with our overall mechanical philosophy, which we will have one isolated episode that allows us to fully discuss what that is for us. But when it comes to swing characteristics / faults, you know, you got to determine, one, is it necessary? But most of the time, it's just excessive movement, typically in some capacity. So us as experts, one, we have to determine, based on what they came to the table physically, do we have to allow that, okay? Or, you know, we've decided that they physically are able to move in a more efficient pattern, allowing us to remove that excessive motion. The way we look at it is like this. The more excessive motion, aka variables, in your golf swing, well, the harder it is going to be to time. And that's as simple as I want to state it tonight. I don't want to go in too much depth there.
Spoiler alert.
But yeah, I mean, you look at sway, you know, naturally, if your weight is shifting to the outside of your trail foot, you're probably not very stable. You're probably not positioning yourself to, you know, be really, really powerful from that position. You know, sometimes we'll say, you know, it's like, you know, you're trying to fire a cannon out of a canoe, you know, right? So it's like, if your ankle's rolling out, you've got all the weight to the outside of it, trust me, you're not going to be nearly as powerful as you would be if you were able to, you know, keep the inside of your foot flush against the ground and rotate internally, accordingly, into that hip. The other part of that is we're not going to go into it in depth yet, but if you're moving excessively laterally with your lower body, their chances are you're probably adding another swing characteristic / flaw to your golf swing, which we'll talk about shortly, and that's a reverse spine, which I'm not going to go into detail, but I will say this. You're putting yourself in a very unstable position that is really, really hard to sequence accordingly in the downswing. And a lot of times when we see those guys swing, yes, some of the issues that we see are fat shots, thin shots. They really struggle with that low point control, which tends to be a symptom of a lot of these swing characteristics. But from a mechanical implication, yes, you're not stable, and you put yourself in a position that is very hard to sequence from.
Nice. So, you know, on the physical side, how do we go about kind of remedying this, giving the golf pro, giving the student a fighting chance of, you know, eliminating this or improving this from their golf swing? So, you know, very obviously just trying to increase internal hip rotation. So a lot of different ways we can do that. Typically, it is a combination of some stretching added or with a strengthening exercise added to it. So I always like to use my elbow as an example of how we increase range of motion in the hip. It's a pretty simple joint to figure out. If you bend your elbow up, your bicep is working. And if you extend your arm out, your tricep is working. So if somebody isn't able to completely straighten out their arm, they could have some tightness in their bicep, or they could have some weakness in their tricep. So what would you do to improve that? We would stretch the bicep, and we would strengthen the tricep. We use that same concept around the hip. So tightness in some muscles can limit that range of motion. So what we want to do is stretch those muscles, typically the external rotators. So we'll get somebody into like a pigeon pose on all fours and cross a leg underneath if there's any yogis out there. Otherwise, lying on your back, little figure four stretch, take the foot, put it across the knee, pull it up towards you. Once we stretch out some of those muscles around that area, what we'll do is we'll do some active internal rotation exercises. I like the hip windshield wiper. Basically, you lie on your back, lift your feet in the air, make two fists with your hands, put them between your knees, and then just take your feet outwards away from each other while you're keeping pressure in against those fists. So that's a nice little combination stretch plus a strengthening exercise that'll help expedite that process for us of trying to get some more hip internal rotation there. As far as trying to improve the separation between your trunk and pelvis, we've got our open book stretch on the floor. We've got some reach back, reach unders. We've got an A-frame stretch. There's a lot of different areas or a lot of different ways we can attack that. But again, we kind of do it in that same methodology. Find a stretch, maybe incorporate a mobilization, but then add a stabilization component to it. Because if you remember, if we go all the way back to that physical screen episode we did, the body's an alternating pattern of stable segments connected by mobile areas. So we have to make sure we hit both that, you know, mobility portion, but then we also need to make sure you're safely moving through that new range of motion that we created there. And then lastly, we want to strengthen those hips and glutes, primarily the glute med. The glutes are king, like I said, as far as the stability goes. Your glute medius is huge in terms of trying to keep that lower body stable and allow you to rotate internally to that hip. You talked about the internal rotation. Two other elements that determine whether you can create that load and keep those glutes and hips firing is you need to be able to stay in your posture. So we talked about losing posture last time. So if you can't stay forward flexed, flexion of the hips, bending forward, you lose the ability to load. Internal rotation is the second component. So you need to be able to rotate into that hip to be allowed the glute to load. And then the third is you need to have, you know, some stability and not sway, because if you lose that out, those are the three elements that allow the glute to load. So if you can't stay in your posture, you don't have any internal rotation, or you allow that weight to get outside it, now you've lost a lot of that power that you talked about before. So,
guys, if you haven't caught on at this point, everything is interconnected. Everything has a cause and effect. And the function of your body is way more important than you realize. Now, keeping this really simple, some straightforward drills I like to use inside the hitting bay, which I just want to say, just listening to you talk, it's refreshing, and it's cool just to be reminded of how fortunate we are as golf professionals here at Smart Golf to have that complementary piece to all of this. One, because it just makes us look that much better as a golf professional, but when you hear it out loud over and over again and you witness it every single day, you just know how important that part is. And you know, the last thing we're ever trying to do is injure any of our clients. And you know, it's actually pretty risky to go after some of these issues if you have not attacked it from its root origin and really attacked the underlying issue. But anyhow, so simple drill, get in golf posture, drop your lead foot back. It's not perfect because it definitely preloads your trail side more than I'd ever probably want ever anyone ever to do in their golf swing. But what I can guarantee you with that is when you drop that lead foot and I've put your arms across your chest and I make you turn into your trail side, it's virtually impossible to sway. So I'm trying to create circumstances, exercises, drills, and opportunities for you to be exposed to a movement pattern that makes it really impossible for you to move in a manner in which we do not desire. So let's say we've explored with that, you know, I've given you that field, and I'm going to have you bring the trail, the lead foot back up, set up a normal address position, see if you can recreate that feel. Another favorite is the Swiss.
Can I interrupt you quick then?
Yeah, sure, go.
The key thing is feel, because, you know, we've talked about a drill before on some previous episodes, and it's probably a common drill of, you know, sticking the directional stick or the bag next to somebody's hip. But you can put that bag there, that directional stick, and tell them not to run into it, but not create the feeling. By dropping that lead leg back, by, you know, creating a little unstable surface for them, you know, to be able to rotate over, it forces that load or they're going to fall over. So the key is the feeling there of trying to figure out what they feel, you know, how can they relate that to, again, a feeling versus just like, I'm trying not to bump this bag over.
Exactly. And I would just like to add to that, where rather than, and don't get me wrong, when I first start the process, I'm going to give you a verbal command. I'm just going to point out to you, hey, man, your hip's moving out to the lateral, you're shifting out to the right side of your foot. You know, can you make a swing where you rotate internally? Chances are you can't, but sometimes you get a young, good athlete and they can do that. But when it comes down to the feel in which you stated, what I love is creating an opportunity where I'm going to give you some objectives. I'm going to give you some bullet points. I'm going to give you an exercise, but I am not going to tell you what to feel, because we've seen it time and time again. You put a guy in that drill and say, okay, where are you feeling? Well, I'm actually feeling my foot really twisted into the turf. Another guy might say, hey, I'm really feeling like, you know, some tightness in my lat. You know, another guy say, I'm really feeling it on the inside of my hip. You don't know. But whatever the feeling is to them, you want them to be able to come up with that answer. Because as we've talked about in past episodes, I wish our job was as easy as delivering information, allowing their, and everyone's interpretation was the same, which then turned into identical intention and identical execution. That's not how it works. So back to the drills. I love a Swiss ball against the wall on your lead side. It's pretty straightforward. Go ahead, put your arms across your chest. Pretend like you're rotating into your backswing. Lead shoulder under the chin. Don't let the ball fall. And then, you know, depending on the circumstances, if we get some guys that are really, they've had years of swing, you know, I might just turn the live video on, draw a line on their lead hip, and I'll purposely have them shift their hips towards the target in their backswing. Not that I want that to happen long term. Not that I want guys loading their lead side in that backswing, but I'm going to do whatever the hell I have to take to, or hell I have to do in order for me to expose their brain to the preferred pattern.
Sure. No, I love that. So moving on.
Yeah,
let's go. Want to go to, I think we got the flying elbow next.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the one where I said, it's not necessarily a swing fault. This truly is a swing characteristic.
Right. And I think opinions have changed on this over the years. I mean, I've seen a lot of like a head cover drill or towel drill into the backswing. I've seen it in the downswing as well. But as far as the backswing, like a lot of times early on, I mean, I think it was preferred to kind of keep that elbow in as tight as possible. And I think people are starting to loosen up on that a little bit. Yeah.
It depends. I mean, how long ago do you think Jack Nicklaus played? Does that fit? I mean, because do you find it, his day more recent or more in the past? Because he's one of the best players ever played the game, and some might define or categorize what he had as a flying elbow.
Sure.
Fairig's no exception. But that's where I want to talk. This one, I think, we'll have a little bit of a lengthy conversation to it. We'll see. But let's define what it is. You know, flying elbow, trail arm on the club, right-handed golfer's right hand. You know, that essentially is your trail arms. The elbow tends to point behind you at the top. Right? We're not saying that's necessarily bad or good. You know, in some cases, like a player should actually be required to swing like that, depending on what we find in the physical screen. But it just depends on how they've gotten there. For me, I don't mind where the elbow points, but I do want it to point in a position that 100% correlates with what I see in the physical screen. But it also has to correlate to what we're seeing in their swing and what their tendencies are. I'm trying not to go too deep into this too quickly. But yeah, for me, when I look at the trail arm, I get a lot more concerned with the extension or flex in the arm, so how straightened or bent it is, more so than where the elbow is necessarily pointing.
But gotcha.
There is it. We've defined it.
Is it fair to say that, you know, the flying elbow is, like you said, pointing straight back or more parallel to the floor, and you would like it just somewhere below that. Doesn't matter where necessarily, but it's pointing somewhere down to the ground, whether it's angled out way behind you or whether it's down, you know, slightly behind you in your shadow. Is that fair to say? Or
yeah, it just depends, right? So if you got it, the concern for the most part with the flying elbow is what happens after that, right? And in a lot of cases, when you get some of these older people, amateurs, they might interrupt their sequencing because they have to give themselves time to get the arms back in front. Or if they're pretty decent athletes and they are sequencing accordingly, now you worry about that trail arm staying behind them.
Getting stuck.
Yeah, and that's the whole getting stuck and virtually putting your body in the way of the swing path, right? So you're looking further into the story of their golf swing, and you've got to, it's whether or not you should be concerned of what happens after that, right? So let's go to the next step. So like,
well, I think,
go ahead.
I mean, I think it's worth highlighting, and the reason my line of questioning went that way is because you have to know what that effect is. Again, so you got somebody come in for a 60-minute lesson, you see the flying elbow, and you don't know what, you know, you taking that flying elbow away because you want it in a different position based on, you know, how you teach the swing and things like that. I mean, that guy is going to be hard-pressed. You're going to be grasping for anything for the last 15 minutes because you haven't thought about what that, you know, the next steps of that process are. You can't accomplish it in 60 minutes.
Like I said earlier, you know, when we look at particular swing characteristics, we want to determine if it's necessary, right? Sometimes, even though our philosophy is let's reduce the variables to make timing easier to solve, sometimes the trade-off of having a swing characteristic that might be considered excessive isn't worth simplifying. Because let me ask you this, when you talk about flying elbow, how many long drivers do you know don't have a flying elbow?
They wouldn't be characterized as long drivers.
Correct. So could flying elbow potentially be thrown into the category of a power move?
Yeah, so let's just go back and strengthen your grip a little bit and move that ball back in your stance a little bit.
I mean, it maybe. I mean, yeah, I know. But it's
the
like,
point.
We're going to unpack this a little bit of where I'm cool with flying elbow and where I'll potentially encourage it. But I think it'll go nicely fall in line with the kind of the theme we're trying to stay with right now. So let's just talk about physical characteristics.
Yeah, physical causes of the flying elbow. So if you have limited shoulder external rotation, if I can, you know, if you put your arm out to the side, your palm is facing towards the floor, and then you rotate your hand and forearm back like you're taking an oath, that's external rotation. So during our physical screen, we want over 100 degrees of that. So if you have anything less than that, you could potentially, you know, that could be causing a potential for the flying elbow. Scapular instability. This one's pretty important. That's strength around your shoulder blades. So again, if you've got adequate strength around your shoulder blade, those shoulder blades should move vertically up and down on your back. If you don't have adequate strength and stability there, they tend to what we call wing out. That, again, limits your external rotation, but it also puts a ton of stress across your rotator cuff, which, again, lends itself to potential soreness and long-term injury. And then the last one is just limited thoracic spine mobility. So, like I said, you're going to hear a few different themes here, but as far as that flying elbow goes, shoulder external rotation is the first place we look. Shoulder blade strength and stability there. Those two go hand in hand in terms of how well that shoulder can move. And then thoracic spine mobility, if you don't have rotation, that's where you tend to do a lot more with your arms because you can't get adequate rotation with the big muscles up top. So.
Yeah, well said. All right. Mechanical implications. So we've kind of discussed this already. One of the biggest concerns with the flying elbow is whether or not they've positioned themselves to where when they sequence in the downswing that the elbow is trailing too far behind them. If we get a guy that has a flying elbow by definition of what we've stated, but they're doing a damn good job at sequencing and getting everything back in front of them, it might not be a concern. You know, the other thing you start to see coupled with flying elbow is a club position that is defined as being a little bit across the line at the top. Technically, if you want a flying elbow, I'd actually probably prefer to see that, which is also another, you know, if you get a guy that's a big slicer that, you know, again, I'm assuming most of our listeners know what that means, but, you know, they're steep, they're swinging really far left, open face, you know, and they've got really, really limited external shoulder rotations, I'm going to purposely give them a flying elbow. I want them to have a flying elbow. They actually require to have a flying elbow because once we give them the flying elbow, one, they might be more powerful. Two, it'll help aid in getting them across. And three, that's a really complementary position to start throwing the club under plane and actually helping shallow and create more draw characteristics. So again, I think this particular swing characteristics, I'm more than accepting to call it that. Just because it's not a flaw. It truly is something that might be unique to the individual. Now, if someone were to say, hey, if you had to draw up a perfect scenario where someone had preferred adequate swing speed and power and had desirable distances, could you make an argument that not having the flying elbow is less excessive movement and therefore easier to time? My answer is yes. You know what? The less you're doing, the easier it is probably to repeat. So if I could design the swing and design the anatomy, yeah, I'd probably want to put you in a position where things are more in front of you, a little bit more short, a little more compact, but that's just not the world we live in.
Nice. So physical improvements, how do we get yourself some more shoulder external rotation? I've been using this wall shoulder series at Lombard. We actually have what we call the shoulder wall there. I've contemplated drawing some or painting some wings on it to look like that drawing that they have in a lot of different cities and stuff like that, because we go over to this small little hallway that's a little bit of wasted space that we're utilizing. One thing you can do is just walk up to a corner of a wall, place your forearm and hand on the wall, and then just try to take your hand and forearm off the wall. So there you're actively creating some external rotation on the shoulder there. If we've got somebody that's, you know, very, very limited, we'd go back to that little model that we said, you know, talked about before. We'd find a stretch to try and find some more motion there, and then we'd have them do that same thing. You can also throw a little weight in your hand and just slowly take it off of there. That way you're working on some eccentric strength to be able to support that shoulder. Because again, if we get past that 90 degrees or 100 degrees, we're putting that shoulder in kind of a compromised position, but we need it to be in that compromised position to be able to get the club into the position we want and have some, you know, some manipulation that we can work with there at the top swing instead of being limited. So as far as scapular stability goes, again, a lot of different ways to do this. One of the tests that we do is the reach, roll, and lift test. It's probably one of the most challenging tests that we do in the screen. We have the person get down into a little kneeling squat position. One forearm, forehead is on the fist of one hand, and then the other arm is reached out on the floor with the elbow straight, palm up. They try to lift from there. A lot of people struggle with that. So what we'll do is we'll get them into that same position, but we'll have their hands on top of like a Swiss ball or on top of a bench. And then with the elbow straight, palm up, we'll have them start to just lift that off there. So we'll actually take that test and work it into an exercise. And that way we can progress it down to the floor and be like, hey, you couldn't do this before, but now you can. Lastly, improving thoracic spine mobility. We've talked a lot about, you know, different ways to do that, so I won't go real in depth there, but just a reminder that first thing we look at is adding extension to the thoracic spine. So getting it a little bit more upright. That will, in turn, allow us to get some more rotation there. So making sure that we've got adequate thoracic spine extension and then lends itself to us being able to attack that rotational component.
So safe to say, if our listeners haven't gathered already, a lot of the limitation in your external shoulder rotation comes from stability and strength limitations, not flexibility limitations in most cases.
Yeah, that's it.
Cool. All right, drills. This one's really straightforward. Assuming that we do not want this player to have anything sort of a flying elbow. You've seen the ball between the forearms. That's a really good one, right? Really tough to get your flying elbow and keep that ball between your forearms. I like a very simple one. I like to take the left hand off the club or lead hand off the club. I like to tuck it under the tricep of the trail arm. So you create a little square. And then I like my players to try to maintain that structure as they rotate to the top. That's probably one of my favorites there. There's a number of them. Those are the two that I think are appropriate to discuss. You know, I do want to just follow up one comment I made earlier where I do have a lot more concern with kind of the extension in the trail arm, which definitely does play a role in the flying elbow as well. I just think, listeners, if you can picture this, when we get to the top and we start to look at some of the best players in the world with that trail arm and you start to look at the angle in which they've created, so obviously if you bend your elbow, you can create a 90-degree angle. Most players are 90 or outside of 90. So when that forearm really starts to approach the bicep, that's where I really start to potentially get a little bit concerned. You see that with guys that have extremely limited rotation. And sometimes it might be the only option because that's the only way they can put that club in a position that gives them any momentum or speed whatsoever. Again, not ideal, not preferred, but might be necessary. And that goes back to the line I say all the time, which is what might be most efficient for you doesn't make it the most efficient in general.
Right. So really, really narrow at the top. So I think wanting to get wider at the top, more narrow on the bottom is just kind of a general theme as far as the swing goes. So.
Yep, you just got to take into consideration what their goals are, what they currently swing at, and a lot of what unfolds after that. And then you can determine there is probably an ideal trail arm position for every single player. I think, the really good athletes probably have a little bit of variation of where that can end up. But, there's definitely flexibility.
Well, I think we're moving on along at a pretty good clip here. We might get all six of these in without anybody falling asleep yet. So want to get into reverse spine angle?
Yeah, so reverse spine, for those who cannot picture, we already talked about one particular swing fault today, and that's a sway, okay? So reverse spine is you get to the top of your golf swing, and your upper body, so your back, is actually leaned towards the target, actually putting a lot of pressure on the lower back. But the reason I bring up sway is what I see being one of the main contributors or causes of reverse spine outside of the physical screen is the fact that the individual does sway because they don't know how to properly load in the backswing, so the hip does kick out laterally. But they know they're supposed to stay centered, right, with their upper body, so they try to stay centered, and that creates the reverse spine position.
Well, one of the faults that we talked about last week also lends itself is that S posture. So excessive 100%. Pelvic tilt, having that pelvis tilted way forward at address also lends itself. So again, like you said, these are connected. One might lead to the other, to the next, to the next. So if we, correct one, it might have a trickle-down effect of, improving some other areas of your golf swing.
Just thinking about this, I might regret saying it later, but I might categorize as reverse spine is one of, pretty close to the top, of one of the worst swing characteristics you could have.
Well, it is.
For several reasons.
Well, it's one of the prime causes of lower back pain in golfers. So you said it puts a lot of pressure on the lower back, which it does. However, the more stress that gets put on the back is actually as they move themselves out of reverse spine, and the sequencing portion really crunches their SI joint, that little bony area on the lower back. So, some other physical causes. Why might we have a reverse spine angle? Why might that upper body point towards the target instead of being able to load behind it or stay centered there? We heard, about this earlier. It's an inability to disassociate, inability for you to rotate your chest and trunk separate of your pelvis. And again, that's caused by spinal limitations as well as lat tightness. So we're starting to talk about the lats, the big back muscles, how they play such an incredible role, and just tightness there, inability for you to lift your arms, up towards the sky, try to get those arms past your ears and up towards the wall, causes a ton of issues as far as the golf swing goes. So we're going to limited hip internal rotation again. So that leads right into what you said. If somebody sways, they are more than likely to probably have some sort of reverse pivot. So that same physical characteristic, not being able to rotate internally into that right hip, will definitely lend itself to a reverse spine. And then just weakness in the core and glutes. So here's where we're going to start to talk about the core and glutes. We talked a little bit about it earlier in the lower body and the glutes and the lateral hip being important there. Now we're going to start to talk a little bit more about the core and its involvement and why it's so important to build a solid, efficient golf swing.
Cool. So mechanical implications, there are several. Number one, Tommy had stated that, it's not necessarily the position at the top that leads to the lower body stress, but it's a sequencing. Well, I would say this is once you're in that reverse spine position, it's actually really, really challenging to sequencing accordingly. Most of the time I see guys sequencing very well outside of that position as they are pretty good athletes, but there is something physical in nature that caused them to be in that position. But that is definitely one position that once you're in and you start sequencing accordingly, it's only a matter of time till you get hurt. So number one, I'd say mechanical implications, it's really hard to sequence out of. It's not a powerful position. So just like with the sway, which is usually coupled with the reverse spine, we talk about being unstable at the top. Well, reverse spine is an extremely unstable position and not very powerful whatsoever. Now, another reason we might see the reverse spine is, again, falling under the category of overswinging. If a guy's all arms in the backswing, disconnected, puts himself in a John Daly position without the necessary core strength, that in themselves will pull themselves right out of posture into reverse spine. Now, once you're in that position, pretty easy to be steep from, pretty easy to be the cliche over the top, pretty easy to hit poles, pretty easy to hit low shots. Yes, you can hit high. You can do anything from that position, really. That's why I would categorize it as one of the worst. But yes, it's unstable, unpowerful, unhealthy. It's not a position you should ever accept in your golf swing.
Right on. So how do we get rid of it? We've got to teach our students what neutral pelvis is. So goes back to that cats and dogs exercise, rotating the pelvis forward, rotating it back. We talked about that in terms of how getting people out of that S posture. So that's, you know, again, get them out of the S posture. We're going to have a much greater probability of getting them to stop reverse spine. So learning what neutral pelvis is, getting them into a good neutral setup posture, out of that S posture is number one. So improving spine mobility, we talked a little bit about how to do that already. And then adding the flexibility of the lats in there. So getting those lats a little bit more flexible, that will allow them to get wider, allow them to get some more rotation into their backswing, and it'll aid in them being able to rotate that torso, the upper part of their body, separate of the hips. And then just, you know, I mean, it's buzzword. It's been buzzword for quite some time, but we're going to strengthen the core. And we're going to strengthen those glutes, you know, so that's going to just help create a little bit more stable platform so that they can actually rotate into that trail leg.
Cool. All right. Favorite drills. Again, I like to determine why the reverse spine exists, not from just a physical standpoint, from a mechanical standpoint. If it's because they sway, well, I'm actually going to attack the sway first and just see what the domino effect is from that. So again, we're going to go with the good old Swiss ball. We're going to put it against the wall. We're going to put their lead hip on the wall. We're going to say, hey, let's make some turns and keeping that lower body, keeping the Swiss ball from falling on the ground. You know, if they're an overswinger and yanking themselves out of posture, we might work on shortening their golf swing. You know, we might even do some of the drills where we put the ball between the forearms, which is going to shorten their swing. Okay, another overlap. We might do the whole lead arm tucked behind the trail arm. Again, that's going to shorten their swing. You might go to hey, let's pretend we've got an extension cord, right? Like we got the bottom of our rib cage, we got the top of our pubic bone. Let's go ahead and plug those in. So I like to put a fist at the bottom of the sternum, fist at the top of the pubic bone. We like to keep those fists touching each other, right? And then as you rotate to the top, see if you can maintain connection. Another good one, depending on how severe the reverse spine is, I might actually purposely ask them to start in a little bit of anterior tilt, a little bit of curve on the back of the dress, and I'll force them to actually move into posterior in the backswing. It's really, really hard, so it's not necessarily my initial play call, but I've definitely have had success with that in the past.
Nice.
Yeah.
You've been fishing with Tate lately?
Oh, I know where we're going now.
Do you? Have you been fishing with Tate lately?
Oh, my gosh. Well, summer's still getting here. So, but yes, I have. We've caught several bass this year already.
Cool. So maybe we should talk about...
You should see that kid cast.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should talk about the casting swing fall.
Okay, casting for our, again, really straightforward. We don't need to spend a ton of time on this, but there's a reason it's calling casting because it's a pattern in the golf swing that looks very, it resembles casting a fishing bowl. And essentially, as we rotate to the top of a golf swing, we create an angle through hinging, cocking, whatever you want to call it, between the wrist segments and the shaft. That angle varies from individual to individual. But a casting, by definition, is allowing that angle to be removed at an excessive amount in the golf swing too early in the golf swing. So I'm excited to talk about, you know, this subject in general because I think that there's some counterintuitive information and drills that we've had a lot of success with that definitely were not the play calls I was making early on in my season. So I'll talk about that here shortly, but that should define what casting is.
Yeah, and you know, just the same as the golf swing, they're often overlooked, but I don't think anybody thinks about their ankle mobility or how well their ankles work when they're trying to throw a rapala into the water there and, you know, catch a little bass or something like that. But essentially, the general overlying theme of casting is just poor lower body involvement in the downswing. So the arms and the upper body kind of take over because the lower body is not involved for whatever reason. And again, that starts from the ankles. So first of all, we look at, can those ankles turn inward and outward? Can we load properly, keep the weight in the inside of that right foot to create some load so that we can transfer weight into that lead side? We look at that hip mobility again. People are probably getting tired of hearing that, but super important. So if you're not working on some hip mobility, you're not doing yourself any favors in terms of, you know, maintaining or improving your golf swing. Inability to separate the lower body from the upper body. So that's on the downswing. So we talked a lot about separating the upper body from the lower body, particularly in the backswing, and we'll talk about both of those in an upcoming fault here in a moment. But in this one in particular, we're talking about being able to separate your lower body from your upper body. So you've completed your backswing, your chest has rotated further than your hips, Now your hips should be able to start turning towards the target before your chest, arms, and the golf club come on down. So any inability to do that is going to affect that sequencing and the involvement of that lower body. Here comes our weakness in our glutes and core again. So if you're weak there, you may have some casting there. And then, wrist limitations, any past injuries or pain, that's a way that your body is going to kind of avoid re-injuring or avoid any pain that you might have in those wrists because it doesn't want to radial deviate, ulnar deviate, might flex and extend, some differences there that we don't want to see. So wrists are definitely something we look at if we see some casting.
Okay, so mechanical implications. Number one, it's a massive power suck. It's not a very powerful position to be in at all. Chances are if you cast it, by the time that club reaches impact, you've added loft to it, and therefore you're not going to be able to compress the ball as much as you would otherwise, and you will lose distance not only from swinging slower, but also through poorer dynamics through the hitting zone. The also issue with casting is it makes timing harder to repeat. If you get a lot last second excessive throwing of the club through the hitting zone, well, that's tough to repeat time and time again, especially as you play under pressure. But, you know, when I look at casting, more times than not, there's a reason the person casts outside of the physical stuff. Like, sequencing is super important. But, you know, what I find out is it actually is kind of reverse engineered. I actually see, due to positions they're putting themselves in at the top of their golf swing and what they're doing in transition, actually immediately interrupts sequencing. Because typically a cast is a response to something else. It's usually because the player has positioned their club head at the top more times than not in an open position. More times than not. Not always, but most times. They got a lot of extension, a lot of cupping in that lead wrist, and they instinctively start to throw it because it helps them square it up earlier. It actually, in some cases, it's required due to some of the other stuff they're doing. But if you're super steep in transition, so this is the number one, if you're super steep in transition and you're trying to hit it straight, you have to throw it. You have to cast it. Otherwise, you're going to hit a big old pole, or you're going to hit big slices, maybe the hosel. Of course, it's possible to hit it straight, but it's going to be few and far between, and it's not going to go anywhere when you do it. So number one, I think when you look at casting, you got to be sure that you're getting down to the root of the issue. Most times, it's because you're steep in transition, and your brain, and if you're an athlete, you're smart enough on a subconscious level to have to toss that club to increase your likelihood to square it up.
Or even hit the golf ball.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so very rarely do I see a person in a great position at the top and transitioning accordingly and slotting it. That's still cast. Now, just so we're on the same page, when I'm looking at video and I've defined it as casting, so if you're looking at someone face on, they're going through the golf swing, I have to go through it. We got P1, we got P2 takeaway, P3 lead arm parallel, P4 top of backswing, P5 transition, maybe P6 because P7 is impact. So P6. So I think that's classified as when the club's parallel to the turf, right prior to impact. I look at a very, very specific spot on the video, and that's when the butt of the club hits the right side for a right-handed golfer of the trail thigh, right thigh. So as soon as the butt of the club on face-on video, so the hands essentially are in front of the leg, I like to see that shaft at minimum parallel. But most cases, even angled still above it. So you'll still have a lot of angle there. There is a little bit of a misconception, which I'll talk about here as I start to unpack the drills of, you know, what some people say is holding the angle. Because when people think of casting, the opposite of that is holding an angle. And I can just tell you from firsthand experience, when I had spent an early portion of my career telling people to hold the angle versus how I communicate it and coach it now, that is not the best strategy.
Bet. All right. There's a lot there. So generally, how do we attack this from a physical standpoint? We want to increase lower body strength and its involvement in the downswing. So we go right after looking at ankle mobility and we look at hip mobility. So number one, we've got to have that mobility there. We've got to have the ankle moving well, the hips moving well. From there, we can look at the ability to create some separation. So one thing I like to do is just walk up to a wall or a doorway, grab onto it, my hands, and then try to rotate my hips. So not hula dance side to side, but try to rotate my hips in a nice round motion while I'm holding something to keep my shoulders stable. If we get pretty good at that, then we can move on to like what we call a stork turn drill, where we stand on one leg, hook one foot behind it. Again, start holding something. Keep the chest and shoulders nice and still, but use that knee as a driver to rotate back and forth to create that motion and separation of the hips rotating separate of the torso. A lot of progressions for that. And then, you know, cliche, but, you know, strengthen the core and the glutes. So we get after that real hard, but we want to make the lower body as strong as possible, and we want to increase the person's ability, their movement pattern, to be able to get those hips to move separate of the torso. And then, you know, lastly, looking at shoulder range of motion, making sure that that's adequate. I didn't mention that in the physical limitations, but oftentimes if the shoulders don't rotate very well, then you're going to make some manipulations there with the wrists, and then looking at the wrist range of motions to make sure that those can do what you want them to do to be able to set the club appropriately and then be able to release it on the way down.
Beautiful. All right, drills. So as I stated earlier, you have to be very clear on why the cast exists in the first place. Most times, more times than not, it's because they're steep in transition. So when I start to coach or attack casting, this is a very complex move because I won't teach it without teaching proper sequencing. And I will not teach it without proper shallowing of the club in transition. Right? So there's a lot there. It could be a multi hour lesson, right? So, but what I'm going to do is, number one, I'm going to position their club and what makes the most sense for them at the top, right? I don't want any drastic outliers unless the physical screen says I need that. But what I like to actually do is start to, you know, teach them how to disassociate. So I'll give them some movement pattern drills that don't look too dissimilar to the physical screen test, right? Make sure they have that, right? Another thing I like to do is I'll have them get to the top, and I'll basically grab their hand like we're shaking hands, but it's more like, you know, this. Trying to describe
like a bro shake?
Yeah, like a bro shake. Yeah. Above the elbow.
Yeah.
But then I'll say, okay, cool. And this is with their lead arm. So they've rotated to the top of their backswing. I've done the bro shake with their lead arm, so left hand for right hand golfers, and I'll say start turning. I'll kind of hold it there a little bit so they can start to rotate internally into that lead shoulder. But more so it's actually adduction, right? The lead arm starts to adduct across the chest. I like them to feel a little bit of that compression, right? Because if they're feeling that compression, the upper body is rotating into the lead arm, which I want them to know how to do. And after I've taught them how to disassociate, well, I know the lower body has initiated because I've told them it has to, followed by the torso, followed by the lead arm. And then from there, I actually teach them how to use the wrist in conjunction. Believe it or not, people, although some players have it, you know, downswing lag where the leg, the angle is actually decreasing in the downswing isn't the easiest way to swing a golf club. And if you're not extremely athletic with a ton of club head speed, having that downswing angle is actually going to be really, really hard for you to play golf with. But there is a throw motion in the downswing that a lot of people, when you're first introducing it to them, be like, dude, isn't this a cast? This feels exactly like a cast. Well, what players need to realize is within that throw action, there's a proper sequence in order of how the wrist should function in transition. I'm going to get a little technical here, but you know, typically we like to see it move a little bit in deflection, so the left wrist will start to bow, and then it'll start to move into honor deviation, right? And then later on, it'll start to supinate. But what I like to do is just teach people how to throw that club with the wrist, which is so counterintuitive, which is crazy to think that when I started teaching people how to throw accordingly. Number one, it shallowed, right? So that's super important. You need to teach the wrist how to appropriately shallow in the golf swing. Otherwise, you're not attacking the root of the issue, and they're going to want to cast it anyway. So teach the sequencing, teach how the wrists are supposed to function, do it in order, you get the shallowing effect. And what's ironic, if you're sequencing and throwing accordingly, although when you stop the video in the frame where the butt of the club hits the trail thigh, it looks like there's an angle being held, trust me, the club is moving towards the golf ball with a lot of speed. So again, it's a pretty complex little swing characteristic. That actually sequence of exercise, movement patterns, exposure, I teach a lot of my players because it's a correction for a lot of issues. But yeah, so that's what I would say. You know, I back in the day, of course, I do hold the angle, punch shots, stuff like that. Some players that, you know, maybe that's necessary and it can allow some dividends to be had. But for the most part, I've had way more success of actually teaching people how to essentially cast it, but the correct way. And then they get the appropriate angles.
Is that why you have like the plastic sheeting and like the buckets in your hitting bay from when people's heads explode to pick up all their brains and put them back in there and stuff like that?
No, you're right, though. I mean, that's the knee-jerk reaction is just like, well, even me as a coach, man, like, wait a minute. I'm telling people to throw the damn club and they've got more lag and angle than they've ever had. Man, no wonder why my job is so hard.
Nice. You have any twins in your family?
Oh, boy. What's the next one here? What's the next one?
Are there
one?
Any twins in your family?
There's no twins in my family that I know of.
Okay. Well, then we'll talk about a cousin because we all have cousins, right? So I like to think of the slide, which is the next fault we're going to talk about, as either the non-identical twin of the sway, or it could be a cousin of the sway. Because there are some characteristics that are very similar, but there are also some vivid differences between the two. You want to walk us through what the slide is?
Slide, by definition, excessive lateral action in the downswing. So again, we like to draw a line outside the lead ankle, straight up. There should be about a 4-5 inch gap between that line and the lead hip. Ideally, we like to see players definitely move laterally. There is some lateral action. Some of the data supports to say 2 to 5, even up towards 6 inches of lateral action in the golf swing. But there's a point where there is a diminishing return, and that robs you of the ability to transfer energy from one segment to the next, along with, you know, some other issues we'll talk about here shortly. But slide's an interesting, I would say, swing characteristic in today's day and age, especially when you start to look at some of the players out there making a lot of money. There are some coaches.
Just live guys? I kid.
There are some coaches that will go to the school of thought that like they find it hard to categorize slide as a swing flaw because it depends, but because you have a lot of room to move laterally.
Again, it's excessive though.
Yes,
excessive.
It's gotta
and
be
it's something
excessive.
That's not complementary to what you're trying to do in the golf swing. So that's where you draw that line.
And it depends on the player. Depends on their body, depends on what their particular swing issue is.
Right. So what causes the slide? We've got limited internal rotation of the lead hip now. So if we remember back to the sway, we were talking about the trail hip, right leg for the right-hander, left leg for the left-hander. Now we're talking about that lead leg, so that left leg for us right-handers and that right leg for the left. So limited internal rotation on that lead leg, inability to disassociate your pelvis from the trunk. Okay, so getting the pelvis to rotate separate of the trunk, like we just talked about in when we were talking about casting, but we also are concerned with inability to disassociate the trunk from the pelvis because we want to get that chest and the arms and everything to rotate through that posted left side. So now we're looking at the ability to be able to do that, both of those things as far as this fault goes, this characteristic goes. So that's why we test both sides. You know, when we go through our screen, we test, can you rotate right and left with your torso? And keep your hips still? Can you rotate the hips right and left while keeping your torso still? So inability to do those things, beating a dead horse here. Again, PETA, no animals were harmed in this episode, but spinal limitations, lat tightness does not allow us to disassociate. And once again, weak lateral hip and weak glutes. So overall weakness in that lower body. Those are kind of the primary things there.
Cool. I'll try to go through this relatively quickly. Mechanical implications, again, sometimes people slide due to something that's happening earlier in the golf swing, right? If you got a guy, again, steep in transition, if you want to add a lot of excessive lateral action near the end of the golf swing prior to the hit, that could allow you to potentially late shallow / plane the club in order to give yourself a better likelihood of hitting the ball towards the desired target. But typically when we see a guy that truly is sliding, has excessive hip action towards a target, the upper body has a tendency to fall backwards. When that upper body starts to fall backwards, obviously you're not rotating, and you tend to put the low point behind the ball. It can lead to a lot of fat shots, which is counterintuitive because when a lot of guys start to hit fat shots, they really think they need to get further left, so they actually start moving their hips even further left. But it's kicking the upper body back behind the ball while it's actually, again, one of those more counterintuitive moves in the golf swing. The other part is if you start to look at sequencing, I won't go too deep into this, but it's like the golf swing is a combination of both accelerators and decelerators. You know, ideally when you start to look at the lower body, yes, the hips are supposed to initiate, start to accelerate, but they've got to decel at the same time. Not actively, not that you're thinking about it, but when the lead leg starts to extend and, you know, you start to reach that end range of motion place, well, that triggers energy transfer into the torso, which then moves through the other segments. But when a guy is sliding and that left knee or lead knee starts to buckle, which again is another swing characteristic, I guess the analogy, I'll bust it out because it's been used for so long. It's like when you're sliding, it's kind of like when you're in the locker room back in the day, we used to snap each other with the towels, right? You pull back on the towel, that puts energy into the tip. It hurts. Well, you don't want
into the tip.
Well, you don't want to be the guy in the middle of the locker room with his arms spread out just spinning in circles, right? There's no D-cell there. You're just constantly going. So one thing you worry about when you're sliding is you rob yourself of the ability to D-cell accordingly to transfer excessive energy into the other segments, ultimately into the clubhead. So, you know, long way of saying it can be a power suck.
Gotcha. So how do we fix it? We're going to increase the hip internal rotation of that lead leg. So we already talked about how to do it in the trail leg. Guess what? It works on the lead leg as well. So we'll increase that internal rotation on that lead leg. We're going to improve that separation. Again, both the pelvis on the trunk and the trunk on the pelvis. So improving our spine mobility, improving the flexibility of our lats will help aid in that dissociation. And then, again, strengthen the hips, strengthen the glutes. If there is one recurring theme you're going to take away from tonight, the stronger your lower body is, the better chance you're going to have to be able to make improvements in your golf swing and perhaps give yourself a fighting chance of not having any of these characteristics, good, bad, or otherwise, present.
Beautiful. As far as drills go, I have a favorite. Honestly, we have these little things we call den caddies. They're little miniature staff golf bags. I like to put it on the lead side. I like to rotate it to where the pocket is kind of on top of the laces. And I'll just start by having players hit some shots where they're not allowed to run into it. Now, prior to that, need to make sure they're not steep. So I'm going to have to correct their transition, make sure they're planting the club accordingly. But then I like to teach sequencing, you know, and, you know, we don't, if we're using the body track or we have the opportunity to use force plate technology. Yeah. I really, really like to explain and show them how pressures work in the golf swing. Right. So, in order to not slide, if you're sliding, you probably don't have a lot of good vertical and rotational force. So, you know, you're probably all lateral. And then don't get me wrong, based on the physical screen, based on their mobility, some guys you might just say, hey, you're better off just moving laterally. Let's keep that. Right? And that's where listeners, you just need to wrap your head around the fact that why they like to call them swing characteristics is because in some cases, that's your best option, even though it's not the most ideal. But yeah, I like to teach them, you know, where the pressure should be at address, where the pressure should be loading into your trail side, where the pressure should be in transition. And I like to teach them how to move that force vertically through the lead leg. So like chances are, if you're teaching someone how to apply appropriate ground force reaction and then you're teaching them vertical forces in the lead leg, really hard to slide and feel both. So, yeah. So again, it's like, sure, there's a lot of drills that could potentially work, but at the end of the day, as you can kind of gather, is it's comprehensive. It's everything kind of ties in with each other. So I'm always trying to teach these all-encompassing movement patterns, athletic movements, just versus like, here's your training aid, here's your drill, here's something in the way. Like, don't get me wrong, there's time and a place for that, especially if you're playing the next day. But if we're truly going to develop a good, solid movement pattern, well, you got to teach the actual movement pattern, you know, yeah. And that varies from individual to individual.
Right. Time for a quick quiz. Do you remember what the number one flaw in my driver swing was and continues to be when I'm having a bad driving day?
You know, the rated R version, PG. you tried to hit it like it was a pitching wedge.
Right. I spent a lot of time, if you remember back to the Founders episode, didn't really know much about golf. Definitely did a lot of flip, you know, a lot of excessive hand motion, de-lofting the golf club or, you know, adding loft to the golf club, things like that. So as I worked on my irons and as I worked on my ball striking, you know, trying to hit down on the golf ball and get stacked kind of on that left side, developed a bad habit into my driver swing, which is the last characteristic we'll talk about tonight, and that's the forward lunge.
That is true, and I remembered. I remember that like it was yesterday, actually.
Nice job.
But now if you watch Tommy out on the golf course, whoof, he's keeping up with the pros here. He's bombing it, especially after that new hip.
New hip swing, baby.
I like that. Okay, forward lunge, pretty straightforward. It's a call to transition move. Get to the top of your golf swing, and the upper body is basically getting out in front of the lower body towards the target. So it's kind of like your upper body is truly lunging towards the target. And I think that's the best way I could describe it at this point. You're just out of sequence. Your lower body trying to get in front. You're creating a position that could potentially feel powerful, but it's definitely going to make it easier to hit down on the ball, which is not preferred with the driver. But again, it's a sequencing flaw. You're out of order. And as we've learned, is, you know, the best players in the world definitely have a commonality with how they sequence and how those particular segments when they reach their peak speeds. And if the upper body is out of order, well, you're screwed.
Right. And I think the big thing to highlight here is that upper body is moving forward. So it's similar to like the slide that we just talked about, but it's primarily that upper body moving excessively forward.
Let's just call it an upper body slide.
There we go. I love it. Why does it happen? Basically due to any limitations that we have that reduces the lower body's ability to be able to shift weight appropriately and rotate. So a lot of different things that we can look at there. Where are we going to start from? We're going to start from the bottom and work our way up. We're looking at ankle and hip mobility. We're looking at glute and core weakness. And then we're looking at poor overall lower body strength. So won't go in depth any more than that, but we really want to know, why are we having that inability to shift weight appropriately? Why can't we rotate into that lead leg?
Cool. Mechanical implications. I'd probably highlight the driver first. Is it's just, again, it's going to be a rob you of distance. It's going to, driver, as hopefully most of our listeners know, it's a club that you want to be hitting up on the ball with. If you're trying to maximize your yardage, I know that the news tour stats came out and, you know, we're seeing a trend with them hitting down on it, but that's by choice because they have a little bit more control and they already hit it 4 miles past you anyway. But so number one, it's not good for driver efficiency. Number two is it's typically coupled with a steep swing plane, right? So you're going to be the guy that's hitting low pulls, potentially slices, depending on what you do through the hitting zone as a response to that. But then two, it's going to rob you of proper sequencing in the golf swing, which then could also be not just a power suck, but an efficiency suck, which is really, really tough to repeat when you've positioned your body in a manner that is going to require more compensations or last second manipulations in order for you to hit a desired shot. I'm sure there's several others, but those are the biggest ones.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I'm going to go to the phone here and see if I can get a caller in here to perhaps Ryan, chime in to how will we go ahead and fix this forward lunge? What are some ways we can attack the physical limitations? Do we have a caller?
Yes. Longtime listener. And
what is happening? You might as well keep going with it.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Timmy.
How long have you been playing, Timmy?
All my life. But I think the way that we fix the forward lunge is by improving ankle and hip mobility. Improving glute and core strength, and improving the ability to separate lower body from upper body. So thank you for the call, Timmy. Keep listening. Tell your friends. The other things I'll add on top of that Timmy.
Now you got me curious. Like, is there a way, which I'm sure there is, we spend enough money on this stuff to where we can allow phone calls. And we got to start doing live episodes.
Yeah, for sure. But improving lower body strength, Timmy didn't touch on that one, but we have a couple times. But then ultimately is learning what a proper weight shift feels like. So feeling what that needs to be, how do we shift weight from that right side to left side? Because a lot of these swing characteristics, we talked about the physical implications, but there can be some misconceptions in terms of like what the person thinks they should be doing in the golf swing, no?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just, you know, perhaps if all of the physical areas clear for any of these, then we know it's a misconception and we need to, you know, help create drills. Exercises in the gym.
I said this earlier, just, you know, we're kind of freestyling now, but it's like, you know, I always, first of all, I know most of the time it's not a misconception, but I always, let's just say from a strategy standpoint, assume that it could be. So when it comes down to my initial play call, it's not even always a drill. It really isn't. It's making sure that I've appropriately communicated the movement pattern that we're not desiring, that we've decided we're going to attack, for lack of a better way of saying it, evolve. And I just say, hey, this is what you do. This is what I need you to do. And I will just give a verbal command, right? Because if it's conception, right, whatever they think they're doing or whatever they're trying to do, they can do. So if it's truly misconception, I should be able to give a verbal command in which they appropriately understand, interpret, get the right intention, and execute accordingly, right? That's how easy our job should be.
No, you need the live video. Because a lot of times, when it comes to the real versus feel type of things, like, you know,
well, I'm
a person.
Joking.
Yeah, I understand.
Right. So, but I will
so
give
was
people
I
the. Okay, Timmy. But I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and just say, hey, because sometimes you get players that surprise you. And let's put it this way. If you're an 18-year-old stud hockey baseball player, I'm definitely starting with a verbal command because there's a really high likelihood you can take it and actually do something with it. You know, but then and after then, if we've determined that I know you're well aware of what you're supposed to do and you're still not unable to make the change, we're clear that it's not a physical issue, well, that's where the drills come into place. That's where the movement patterns come into place. That's where the high repetition. And go back to another podcast and listen to deliberate practice. So that's where that starts to kick into effect.
Nice. Wow, that was a lot.
Did we finish?
Did you give us a drill for the forward lunge?
Here's my favorite drill for the forward lunge, especially if you're working on driver. I just like to simply hold a shaft to the lead side of the head. And then I will actually literally, if you're working on driver, I will make the individual end up further away from the shaft than they were at address. So if you start to go look at some really good drivers of the ball, you start to look at their 2D video, yes, their head actually moves away from the target through the hitting zone. It's a really good way to hit up on it. But again, I'm teaching them disassociation. I'm teaching them sequencing. Not too dissimilar to help correct a lot of the other issues in order for them to hit up on the ball. But I'll just give you my favorite drill, and that's the shaft to the left side of the head. What?
Sorry. You'll have to say that. But,
I know what you're picturing.
We'll just leave it at that. But great episode. I think if there's anything that we can take away from here is make sure you get yourself a physical screen. We're going to come on back with some more of these swing characteristics that we'll break down and make sure we get through all those.
Guys, everything's interconnected. There's a reason a lot of those swing characteristics, faults, misconceptions, whatever you want to exist, I can tell you for the most part, it's not because of your conceptual understanding. And it goes way deeper and beyond that. And hopefully through listening to some of these latest episodes, you're starting to really understand and value knowing how your body truly functions.
Cool. Get this.
Cheers. Have a good night, Timmy.
A big thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Everything But the Tip podcast. Stay connected with us on all social media platforms by following @SmartGolfFitness. For additional episodes, updates, and exclusive content, check out our website at smartgolffitness.com. Don't forget to show some love, like, share, and subscribe to ensure you never miss out on the latest insights and engaging discussions. Your support means the world to us. Until next time, keep swinging and stay fit.